you. During the past year, United States military forces have been directly engaged in combat in Lebanon and Grenada, while the United States continued to escalate its war against Nicaragua, fought with mercenaries in this case, and to increase its support for terrorist regimes in El Salvador, Guatemala, and elsewhere, which are busily at work slaughtering their civilian populations. Meanwhile, Honduras is being converted into a military base, in fact, the center for U.S. Aggression and counterinsurgency and subversion in the region. It's playing a role rather similar to that of Thailand about 25 years ago in the early stages of the American attack against South Vietnam, then all of Indochina. That is the event that's called the Defense of South Vietnam in official party history. All of these, a predictable consequence of the increased U.S. intervention in Honduras is that the is a growth, an increase in the usual concomitants of the American presence, namely death squads, torture, disappearance, murder, and corruption, and deterioration of what little there is of a democratic system, but that's familiar. Direct U.S. participation in the regional wars is also increasing. For example, direct U.S. control of airstrikes against Nicaragua and the minings of the Nicaraguan harbors, which was reported recently, and U.S. Air Force reconnaissance to increase the capacity of the Salvadoran army, which is in effect an American mercenary army, to massacre the civilian population there with greater facility and efficiency. Again, all of this is quite familiar from the early days of the U.S. war in Indochina. This escalation of the United States' role in directing international terrorism, this is a completely unsurprising consequence of the commitment of the Reagan administration to militarizing the domestic economy and increasing the role of the state increasing essentially the state sector in the domestic economic system. That is, it's quite typical, not only for the United States, it's quite typical that domestic militarization, which is our technique for increasing the state sector of the economy, it's quite familiar and common and natural in a way for domestic militarization to go hand in hand with international terrorism and with the search for confrontation with some evil empire. In fact, the most obvious recent example of that in our own history is the Kennedy administration, which the Reagan administration very closely resembles in many ways. I'll give some examples later on. I want to discuss these underlying factors, these long-term factors. I'll concentrate here on Central America and the Caribbean, although I want to stress that we often get misled about that. The United States is a global power, and what happens in one area is a reflection of factors that are also showing up in other areas as well, and that in fact are showing up through history. The scope of what I'll talk about then is in fact global, and I want to stress that the Reagan administration is not particularly original in the kinds of policies that it is carrying out. These are things that we should try to understand if we want to have any conception of what is going on in the world and will continue to go on unless we act to stop it during the few years that may be left before policies of this kind lead to a superpower confrontation and a nuclear war, and with it the termination of the human experiment. Well, some of the long-term continuities are indicated by the title of this talk. The title was A Hemisphere to Itself, and in fact it was Thomas Jefferson who coined that phrase. He said that America has a hemisphere to itself. And in fact, we can learn a good deal, if we'd like, about our own institutions and our own culture if we pay some attention to what the United States has done, what we have done in our hemisphere. That's a topic that we can learn a good deal about. Time being short here, I'm going to concentrate on recent years with only a few glimpses into the past. Well, let's begin with right now, with May 1984. As you probably know, May 1st, 1984, was designated Law Day 1984 by a presidential proclamation. elsewhere in the world outside the United States, May Day is a different holiday. It's a workers' holiday, and we might remember that it was called originally in solidarity with the American workers who were struggling for an eight-hour day and were being shot down by the police and so on. But in the United States, it's a day for patriotic speeches and so on. I'm told, incidentally, that in Malawi also they don't celebrate it, but I think elsewhere they do. Anyway, here it's Law Day 1984 and the Presidential Proclamation. In the Presidential Proclamation, President Reagan hailed, I'm quoting now, a 200-year-old partnership between law and liberty. Without law, he said, there can be only chaos and disorder. That was the Presidential Proclamation. Well, the timing was quite exquisite. Law Day USA was proclaimed by the president on April 9th. That was the day on which Nicaragua brought to the International Court of Justice its charges against the United States for mining its ports and for attacking its territory. The day before the presidential announcement of Law Day, as part of his tribute to the rule of law, President Reagan had announced that the United States would not recognize the decision of the World Court, which, of course, the United States was instrumental in establishing. Well, so the timing was instructive, but the history is also instructive. Fact is, there's nothing new in this. This is a repetition of earlier history, much earlier history. 80 years ago, the United States established the Central American Court of Justice. This was to bring the rule of law to our hemisphere. This was shortly after presidential advisor Brooks Adams had described what we here call the Spanish-American War, but other people have another name for it. What he described that as the turning point in our history. He said, I do believe that we may dominate the world as no nation has dominated it in recent time. And in order to bring the law to one part of our the area that we dominated, the closest part, the Central American Court of Justice was established primarily at United States initiative. In 1912 and 1916, the United States refused to recognize court decisions which concerned U.S. intervention in Nicaragua, just to show you how the world changes, and the court was dead, essentially. That's last gasp was in 1922 when there was a conference of Central American states called by Secretary of State Charles Hughes, and the United States insisted that there be no reference whatsoever to the Central American Court in this conference. So that was the end of that. Note that the final blow was administered by Woodrow Wilson, who was, of course, the well-known apostle of self-determination, as he demonstrated by invading Mexico and Haiti and the Dominican Republic, among other accomplishments. Wilson's Secretary of State, the progressive William Jennings Bryan, was much amused by the Haitians at the time of one of our many invasions of Haiti, but the one that took place under Wilson. He expressed his opinion of the Haitians in the following remark. He said, dear me, think of it, niggers speaking French. His successor, Robert Lansing, also a progressive statesman, also under Wilson, observed that the African race are devoid of any capacity for political organization and have no genius for government. So we have to stay there and show them how to do it in Haiti. The real ruler of Haiti was Marine Commandant Waller. He was fresh from atrocities in the Philippines. In fact, he was the person who had carried out the orders to turn the island of Samar into a howling wilderness, burning everything and killing everybody there. He had come from there to, that was the Spanish-American War, in which we liberated the Philippines and also permanently pacified several hundred thousand people. He came from there, a few other, under the Wilson administration, he was taking over Haiti, and he was very bitter, actually, at having to deal with these Haitian mulattoes. In his words, real nigs beneath the surface, a collection of coons, and that is true no matter how elegantly they talk. What particularly bothered him about them was that a lot of them studied in Paris and were giving all sorts of disquisitions about continental philosophy, but they were just nigs beneath the surface. Meanwhile, the Marines reintroduced slave labor, killed several thousands of people with much torture and brutality, They also administered what was called a democratic election, carried out under American guns, and leaving a legacy that remains to this day in a country which is one of the most brutalized and miserable and impoverished in the world. While Wilson's was bringing self-determination to Haiti in this fashion, he also brought the rule of law to the Dominican Republic. The Marines took over there too, burning villages, torturing prisoners, and in general, policing SPIGs, as the phrase was at the time. We at that time, in case you didn't know it, we were fighting the Germans, just like now we're really fighting the Russians in El Salvador and Nicaragua. The Marine Commandant, Thorpe, when new Marine arrivals would come to the Dominican Republic, he would tell them the following, that they were serving the country just as valuably as were their fortunate comrades across the seas in Europe, and the war would last long enough to give every man a chance against the Hun in Europe as against the Hun in San Domingo. And he went on to say that there must be German provocation, he said, whoever is running this revolution in Haiti is a wise man. He is certainly getting a lot out of the niggers. It shows the handwork of the Germans. And then he said he hoped that if he did a good job of clearing these provinces of insurgents and killing a lot, it ought to demonstrate that I'd be a good German killer. So after killing the Hun in the Dominican Republic, he could go off and kill the Hun in Germany. This is useful to remember. Remember, this is before the Bolshevik Revolution, so we didn't have that evil empire to fight. And we weren't fighting the Russians when we were killing people in El Salvador and Dominican Republic and so on. In those days, we were killing the Germans. And before that, we were, you know, somebody else and so on. But whether it was the Huns or the Bolsheviks or whatever, it always ends up that we're slaughtering the local population. It's one of the uniformities that seems to be rather surprising. The basic doctrine behind all of this was expressed rather well by Theodore Roosevelt, in this case in connection with the Philippines. He said, "The most ultimately righteous of all wars is a war with savages, though it's apt to be also the most terrible and inhuman. But it is idle to apply to savages the rules of international morality which obtain between stable and cultured communities." Well, this is all from the early part of the century. Let's see how much things have changed as civilization has advanced. And let's come to today. Today, for example, we can read in the New York Times the reaction of Norman Podhoretz to the invasion of Grenada, which he found, in his words, inspiriting. He said, "It points the way back to recovery and health, overcoming our sickly inhibitions against the use of military force." That's a very familiar phrase. In fact, it's straight out of the Nazi literature. Goebbels couldn't have put it better. That's the conservative side. We're overcoming the sickly inhibitions against the use of military force. Let's turn to the liberal side. There we have, for example, the following contribution. This is from the New Republic on April 2nd. The New Republic is more or less the official journal of American liberalism. It's where the mainstream and left liberals and liberals write and continue to write. And they had long editorial on Central America in their April 2nd issue, which I really urge you to read. It's rather revealing. It began with advice to the Reagan administration. They said the Reagan administration should stop misleading the country. And here I'll quote, "The Reagan administration, if it is honest, must argue bleakly that there are higher American priorities than Salvadoran human rights. Human rights meaning in this context not anything so elevated as democracy, but simply the physical security of persons who may or may not be suspected of potential anti-oligarchical sympathies." Okay, so they're talking about the right of not being, you know, not being tortured and having, you know, your head cut off and so on, that sort of thing. That's the kind of human rights they're talking about. But they say we have higher priorities, and the Reagan administration must argue it. And going on, "Because of these higher priorities, military aid must go forth, regardless of how many are murdered." Okay, so in other words, even if we kill them all, military aid must go forth because we have higher priorities than human rights. "And this aid," they say, "will go to I'm quoting all the way through. "This will go to Latin-style fascists." And the reason is, given a choice between communism and war for the people of El Salvador, no doubt the American people will choose the latter. Of course, it's taken for granted that the American people have the right to make a choice for the people of El Salvador. That's obvious. And we will choose, given a choice between war and communism for them, we've chosen war, so we'll go on killing them regardless of how many are murdered. They go on to say that non-intervention long ago disappeared as a thinkable option, and they end by concluding that in the end, the only moral choice may be military intervention for the highest moral purposes, of course, because this is a liberal journal. Well, that's the liberal side. So on the conservative side, we have the idea that we've finally overcome our sickly inhibitions against the use of military force and recovered the health of our society. As I said accurately, a comment straight out of the Nazi archives. And on the liberal side, we have the conception that we should go on murdering people in El Salvador regardless of how many are murdered, a statement which, as far as I know, doesn't even have an analog in the Nazi archives, but maybe one can find one. Incidentally, let me mention, stress that all of this goes on without comment, right? Like there isn't any letter in the journal saying there's something funny about this. And no writer who writes for it thinks that there's something odd about contributing to such a journal. They're very upset about Jesse Jackson's alleged anti-Semitism, but not the idea that in the main journal of American liberalism, we call for murdering the people of El Salvador regardless of how many are murdered, and giving the aid to Latin American fascists, and because we have decided that the choice for them is for all of them to be dead rather than to be communists. Well, again, there's nothing new about this, and let me shift back to the earlier to an earlier period, the most striking being the Philippines, and let's take a look at what the press was saying at that time. Here's the New York Press. Whether we like it or not, we must go on slaughtering the natives in English fashion and taking what muddy glory lies in the wholesale killing until they have learned to respect our arms. The more difficult task of getting them to respect our intentions will follow. Okay. Now, that's a common theme in American literature, if you look through. We're there for the best of with the best of intentions, but the natives never seem to understand it somehow. So we always have to keep slaughtering them until they finally realize how good our intentions are, and then we can carry out our intentions. You hear this today, but you're not hearing anything new. This goes back to the origins of American history. It's very deeply rooted in our institutions and our culture, and that's something that's worth understanding. Let's turn to the Western press, the Salt Lake City Tribune. It said, again about the Philippines, the struggle must continue till the misguided creatures there shall have their eyes bathed in enough blood to cause their vision to be cleared, and to understand that not only is resistance useless, but that those whom they are now holding as enemies have no purpose toward them except to consecrate to liberty and to open for them a way to happiness. Again, the standard theme in American journalism and scholarship as well for many, many years. The Republican National Convention stated that the American people have conducted and in victory concluded a war for liberty and human rights. You really have to go back and see what that war was to understand the meaning of those words. It was real genocide, you know, real massacre. In fact, it ended up with a lot of people being court-martialed, although they all then became commanders and, you know, chief of staff and so on afterwards. Scholarship also got into the act at that time. At that point, the field of sociology was just being created, and one of the early contributors in the United States was a scholar named Franklin Henry Giddings. He coined the marvelous idea, he coined the phrase, consent without consent. And that was to explain the following principle, which I'll read you. If in later years the colonized see and admit that the disputed relation was for the highest interest, it may be reasonably held that authority has been imposed with the consent of the governed. Okay, you get the idea? In other words, we slaughter them for a while until they finally understand that we're there for the best for their interests. And once they understand that, that means that we really did it in the first place with their consent. It's sort of the way you train a two-year-old or three-year-old. You know, the three-year-old wants to run across the street, but you force the three-year-old not to run across the street. And later, when it grows up, it realizes that you had its best interest at heart, so you were really doing it with its consent all along. This is the way, this is our relationship to colonial peoples as well. I should say that there were some who were less, who were more honest. For example, Senator Henry Cabot Lodge, who said, "We make no hypocritical pretense of being interested in the Philippines solely on account of others. While we regard the welfare of these peoples as a sacred trust, we regard the welfare of the American people first. We see our duty to ourselves as well as to others. We believe in trade expansion. That gets a little more to the point. Well, let me return to contemporary Central American history. In El Salvador, as in Nicaragua and Guatemala, the main target of U.S. terrorism is the civilian population. In El Salvador, refugees are now reporting that bombing of civilian targets has become much more accurate in the last few months. This is, of course, a direct consequence of the involvement of the U.S. Air Force in coordinating airstrikes and selecting targets and coordinating ground attacks, too. The press has minimally reported each of these facts, but not the obvious conclusion from their correlation. Towns and villages have been destroyed and abandoned in the last few weeks. Many people are starving. People are now hiding in caves trying to survive. Again, all this is familiar from Indochina. The bombing has, in fact, reached the terror bombing scale, where people have to try to hide in caves to survive and that kind of thing, as went on in Laos and Cambodia and South Vietnam for many years. Refugees and soldiers in the U.S.-trained elite battalions, the Atlacatl Brigade, report that the Air Force is now making extensive use of napalm and phosphorus bombs in its attacks against the civilian population. Although these reports are recent, in fact, they go back quite a ways. About a year ago, or more than a year ago, in February 1983, there were reports of the use of napalm, and they were investigated. They were investigated by the president of the Salvadoran Commission on Human Rights, Marianela Garcia Villas, but we don't have her report because she was murdered by the U.S.-trained Atlacatl Brigade. That's the elite unit that has achieved outstanding results, in fact, in massacring defenseless civilians. At the time, the Western press said that she was probably a guerrilla, like the nuns who were killed and so on. But that, anyway, took care of that. I think she was the eighth person from the Salvadoran Committee of Human Rights to be murdered within a few months. One recent innovation in our attack against El Salvador is coordinating airstrikes with a distribution of food by relief agencies. So shortly after, say, the Red Cross goes into some area to distribute food when it's likely that people will be gathered, because after all they're starving given the effects of the bombing and so on, then the Air Force can come in and really kill a lot of them quickly, so increasing the kill per hit, as they say it. This, in fact, has led the international relief agencies to stop distributing food in many areas. I'll again spare you the ample precedents. Well, the picture, the world that's presented to us in the media and scholarship and journals of opinion, it's quite different from the world that I've been briefly describing. In the more comfortable world of what we ought to call the party line, the United States plays a defensive or reactive role in world affairs. That is, others, you know, the Huns or the Bolsheviks or somebody, others carry out actions and we just react to their actions. That's the first principle. The second principle of the party line is that we are committed to what's called Wilsonian self-determination. And the third principle is that we're committed to human rights, the rule of law and justice. Now, it's recognized that sometimes in our innocence and naivete, we fall into error, even what's called sometimes tragic error, as in Vietnam, where our involvement arose, I'm quoting now, arose from an excess of righteousness and disinterested benevolence. Those words are due to John King Fairbank in his presidential address to the American Historical Association in December 1968. Or they arise from blundering efforts to do good, the words in that case being those of Anthony Lewis in the New York Times in 1975. I quote Fairbank and Lewis particularly because they're at the left end, at the dissident end of the mainstream of opinion. So I won't even bother with what they say on the other side. But what are called dissidents here, you know, people sort of so far out there, barely in the mainstream, say things like what I just quoted. Hey, fortiori, the rest. I won't bother with that. That's the official line. It's also presented by, for example, Arthur Schlesinger, who's also described as an anti-war leader and a dove and so on. With regard to Carter's human rights policy in 1977, he said that that human rights is replacing self-determination as the guiding value in our foreign policy. So that is, up till 1977, it was Wilsonian self-determination which was the guiding value in our foreign policy, but now it's shifting more towards human rights. Again, notice that these are all quotes from the dissident side of the spectrum. Well, that's a comforting picture, and that is, in fact, the dominant, overwhelmingly dominant picture in the media and journals of opinion and most of scholarship. And now let's begin to compare it, or continue to compare it, with the real world, keeping to Latin America and looking at these three doctrines. If we look at them closely, we can learn something. Let's begin with the first doctrine, that the United States plays a defensive role in world affairs. There's a lot to say about this, and it's misleading only to talk about Latin America, but let's focus on that. In fact, if you look at the American military buildup since the Second World War, you'll notice there are three periods when a large military buildup was initiated domestically. One was in 1950, the second was in 1961, and the third is in the period from late 1978 until today. We're now in the middle of the third of these. Let's take a look at each of them. In 1950, the timing is important. It was a couple of months before the Korean War. The Korean War was used as an excuse to carry out the buildup that was already planned, but the quadrupling of the military budget, which was carried out that time, was planned before the Korean War. And in fact, the logic of it is explained clearly in the important document NSC 68, which says that, written right before the Korean War broke out, by Paul Nitze, who's still active in international affairs, luckily for the world. This was a couple of months before the Korean War broke out, and there they said that the Cold War is a real war. It called for a rollback strategy in which we have to break up the Soviet Union and maybe negotiate with some successor states or something of that kind. And it said that at home we have to have sacrifice and discipline, no nonsense about freedom of speech. We don't have time for that in a real war. Sacrifice, can't waste our resources on luxuries. We have to prepare for this battle. It's very interesting reading, not only because of its hysterical and paranoid style, but because of the fact that there's also an element of rationality. In this respect, it compares interestingly with the Kissinger Commission report in both respects. It does point out that we're overwhelmingly more powerful than the Russians in every respect, economic, military, and so on, but nevertheless, we have to defend ourselves by sacrifice and discipline and by rollback and so on and so forth. All right, that was one right before the Korean War, and then came the Korean War and the huge increase in military spending already planned. The second was 1961, the third today, roughly, 1978 to today. Well, one question that one would immediately ask is, what was this a response to? Since we're a defensive power responding to somebody else's actions, what were the actions that we were responding to in these three cases? And the answer, if you look, is that there were none. There were no threats. There was no relevant change in international affairs. In fact, nothing relevant had changed. Pretexts were used, like the Korean War, but remember that the planning was made before it. The same was true in 1961 and in 1978. The current Reagan buildup began in the latter part of the Carter administration. What we do find, there is, of course, we also naturally, since there was no real threat, no real action that motivated these buildups, we find fakery. So, for example, the missile gap of the Kennedy administration, fabricated by the Kennedy administration, was used to justify the tremendous expansion of the strategic weapons system, and even if one can believe that they didn't know about that this was a fraud before the election, they certainly knew it afterwards. Within a few weeks of coming into office, they knew that it was a fabrication, that it was a fraud, but it was dismissed and they went on anyway. We just went through the same thing again with the window of vulnerability. There was supposed to be a window of vulnerability, which meant the Russians were going to take over the world and so on and so forth. The window of vulnerability was in fact opened wider by the Reagan administration because in fact it happened that it phased out various missiles before new ones came online, so the Russians should really be practically at our doors. But the window of vulnerability was closed anyway by the President's Scowcroft Commission, but that didn't have any effect at all. Because, of course, that had nothing to do with the military buildup. So what we find is no external threat motivating it, a lot of fakery to justify carrying out the military buildup. So what's going on? What is there about these three periods? And we do find something that runs through them. In fact, in each of these three periods, there was considerable concern about stagnation of the economy. There was considerable fear that we might head into serious recession, that we had to do something to get the country moving again, as the Kennedy people put it. or to reindustrialize America, as the Reagan guys put it, or to avoid sinking back into the Depression, which everybody knew we got out of only because of the Second World War, and so on. In each of these three periods, we do, in fact, find this. And we find that the United States undertook practices which are common in other countries, too, but have become a routine here, namely to expand the state sector of the economy to carry out what's called military Keynesianism, that is, to build a guaranteed market for high technology production and to create a major subsidy from the state, meaning the taxpayer, to the most advanced sectors of industry, and we do that in our system through the military system. So domestic militarization is the technique for intervention and state intervention in the economy, and that's true even if it's somebody who uses free market rhetoric like Reagan or somebody who uses state capitalist rhetoric like Kennedy or Truman, but it's the same policy. So the rhetoric is sort of irrelevant. I mean, there are policies, just as the alleged threats are irrelevant, there are real reasons having to do with economic planning, with industrial planning, with so on and so forth. It's true that each of these three times we do find that. Now we find more, and I'll come to that. Domestic militarization typically, as I said before, typically coincides with an aggressive foreign policy, with a search for confrontation and an increase in intervention. This is not only true of the United States, but we're talking about that, so let's look at the United States. And the reason for that is easy enough. In fact, the reason was stated rather nicely by H.L. Mencken, I think back in the 20s, when he said, "The whole aim of practical politics is to keep the populace alarmed and hence clamorous to be led to safety by menacing it with an endless series of hobgoblins, all of them imaginary." Well, that's more or less accurate. That's the real aim of practical politics. And this lesson is a particularly important one in a period when the government is resorting to military Keynesian techniques of industrial policy in order to overcome the threat of stagnation, to get the country moving again, and so on. That is, somebody's paying for this. You know, the taxpayer is paying, and the taxpayer has to be kept frightened, has to be frightened enough to be willing to pay for this transfer of resources from the poor to the wealthy, that gift to the wealthy, in order to bribe them to get the economy going again, which is our technique of industrial policy planning. In order to get people to accept that and pay for it, you got to frighten them. You have to menace them with a series of hobgoblins and so on, and as Mencken put it. So it was quite predictable from the early days of the Reagan administration, as soon as their domestic program appeared, and in fact from the latter days of the Carter administration, it was entirely predictable and predicted, though not in the mainstream, that this government would in fact search for international confrontation. It would search for any mechanism it could to get into a confrontation with the evil empire and to extend their aggressive actions overseas and so on. And in fact, that's been happening. They've been using all sorts of target of opportunities. Central America, Libya has been kind of useful, Libyan hit squads running through the capital, you know, aiming at our leader and that sort of thing. Libyan attacks on the Sudan, which are so secret that the Sudanese intelligence never heard about them. The amazing story of KAL-007 is an interesting case. There's no time to talk about that. But that's a really interesting one, the way the media lined up in service of the state, exactly as would happen in a totalitarian state. That's a very interesting story. If there's some time later, I'll come back to it. But all of these things are exactly what you expect. You need confrontation. You've got to keep the population terrified because they're paying for all of this. It's not coming from nowhere. And that's with regard to the search for confrontation with the evil empire. A similar things can be said about intervention. Again, consider Latin America. And consider these three moments, 1951, 1961, and today. Let's look at what happened in Latin America at these three times. We could say the same thing about other parts of the world. In fact, let me stress again, it's kind of misleading and a mistake to do what we usually do, namely discuss one aspect of American foreign policy, and to separate it from domestic policy. This is all unified, all flows from the same sources. It doesn't flow from something out there, you know, it flows from something here, just what is insulated from study and closed off from study. So let's take a look at these three moments in Latin America, our present concern. 1951. Well, 1951, the period of the quadrupling of the military system in order to prevent us from sinking back into depression, that was accompanied by programs in Latin America. In fact, that's when we began the major programs of training Latin American officers, training them in counterinsurgency, and also increasing military aid. All of that went up, as you'd expect, along with the program of militarization of the domestic economy. And it had its consequences. By 1954, there were military dictatorships in 13 out of 20 Latin American nations. That was a new high for the 20th century. Guatemala was the most interesting, important case, where a democratic government modeled more or less on Roosevelt's New Deal was overthrown by a CIA coup, and the country was turned into one of the world's worst torture chambers. But that was only one of these of the consequences, perfectly predictable consequences, of increase in training for Latin American military officers by the United States and increase in military aid. That's what you'd expect if you were rational, and that's what happened. Let's turn to 1961, when the Kennedy liberals came in. Well, one of the things that they did was change, along with the big development of the strategic weapon system and 1,000 Minutemen and all that kind of stuff, which in fact set off the current phase of the arms race, you know, that's what set it off. Along with that, there were policies with regard to Latin America. And the most important of them was a decision to change the mission of the Latin American military, which this decision was taken in 1961. And of course, we can determine the mission of the Latin American military. That's, again, taken for granted, just as we take for granted that the American people will choose between war and communism for the people of El Salvador. So here the Kennedy administration changed the Pentagon under the Kennedy administration, changed the mission of the Latin American military in 1961, and they changed it from hemispheric defense to internal security. Now, hemispheric defense was, of course, a joke. There was nobody to defend Latin America against except the United States. But internal security, on the other hand, is not a joke at all. Internal security is just a euphemism for war against your own population. So, in fact, what happened in 1961 is that the Kennedy administration changed the mission of its various mercenary forces throughout the, and client forces throughout the hemisphere, from meaningless hemispheric defense to very meaningful war against their own populations, internal security. And that had its consequences. In fact, in terms of its consequences, this was one of the major decisions of the 20th century, and I'm not exaggerating. The consequences were enormous. Of course, it's little known here. You wouldn't expect it to be. But it's very well known, or at least the consequences are very well known throughout the hemisphere. What happened is that this set off a plague of repression throughout the hemisphere, which in fact had no precedent in the whole bloody history of Latin America, as country after country fell into the hands of murderous military dictatorships, national security states with a kind of a neo-Nazi ideology, committed to torture and murder and service to foreign corporations on the side, of which the only beneficiary, there were beneficiaries, namely elite groups linked to American corporations, but for the rest of the population, it was a tragedy of a kind, a bloody, murderous tragedy of a kind that had no history in what is a very bloody history, in fact, that of our hemisphere. This was a direct consequence of the decision of the Kennedy liberals in 1961. It's worth noting that many of the worst murderers and torturers were specifically trained by the United States. These references to the U.S. trained elite battalions before are quite typical. For example, Rias Montt, who carried out the worst massacres in Guatemala's history, and that's saying a lot. He even got the very conservative Guatemalan bishops to talk about genocide. Genocide was their term. But he was then overthrown because he was considered insufficiently violent, and also he was considered a little bit too independent. He wasn't entirely taking American officers, and there was also some minimal threat that he might be thinking about land reform. So he was overthrown in a military coup. But when he came in, he set off a really effective major massacre. Incidentally, this was essentially 1982. Nobody knows how many people were killed, maybe 10,000 or something like that in a few months. This led to a certain kind of respect in much of the West, civilized West. For example, the London Economist compared the success of counterinsurgency in El Salvador, in Guatemala, with the lack of success of the United States. We were killing about the same number of people, but with less success in El Salvador. And they suggested that this probably showed the relative greater efficiency of the Israeli advisors who were conducting the Guatemala insurgency, counterinsurgency, as compared with the American advisors who were conducting the El Salvador insurgency. Incidentally, the Israeli advisors means, again, American mercenaries. As a client state, Israel, with virtually no economy, Israel can do nothing without American payment and support. But they suggested that the relative success of these two murder massacres, roughly equivalent in scale, might be due to this. Well, maybe. Anyway, Rias Montt was trained at Fort Bragg and was the director of director of studies at the Inter-American Defense College in Washington before he went on to conduct a massacre in Guatemala, which the very conservative Guatemalan bishops, they are very conservative, called genocide. There's also been direct U.S. participation in this, as you'd expect, all the way through. There's no time to give a lot of examples, but I'll merely mention the role of the Kennedy administration in setting up the basic framework for the death squads in El Salvador in the early 1960s, picking the people, setting up the intelligence apparatus, beginning the organization of the death squads, which have continued with direct American. This was done under the rubric of the Alliance for Progress, and it's probably the only lasting consequence of the Alliance for Progress. This is part of the Kennedy legacy in El Salvador. It was maintained with direct American participation, providing intelligence, organizing massacres, training the torturers, and so on up till today. It isn't something that happens because of bad Central American genes. It's something that's coordinated, planned, organized here for rather rational reasons. Well, that was the second of the two major American buildups here, and their consequences in Latin America. Let's turn to the third, late 1978 until today. Let's begin by looking at El Salvador. There was a reformist military coup in El Salvador in October 1979, which carried out by reformist junior officers. The United States, the Carter administration, the Human Rights Administration, theoretically supported it, but on some conditions, the conditions being that the ultra-right and most murderous members of the military, the top military establishment, be put into the junta and the top government. So they were, and in fact, they pretty quickly took over. Within a few months, they'd taken over. And the next year, 1980, was a year in which the Carter administration devoted itself with considerable success to a massive slaughter in El Salvador with quite specific aims. The purpose was what had happened in El Salvador during the 1970s was kind of dangerous. Lots of popular organizations had developed. The Catholic Church had developed base communities. There had been peasant cooperatives. There were unions, student organizations. In fact, it looked as if the basis for democratic politics, which of course requires organizations of people, there's no democratic politics otherwise, it's a fraud, the basis for democratic politics was being established, and also possibly the basis for overcoming, for carrying out reforms which are really desperately needed in a country which has potential resources and even an economy, but totally controlled by a tiny elite, it's sometimes even been called the Ruhr of Central America. It's also one of the countries with the highest rate of starvation and malnutrition. So the basis was begun in the 70s for dealing with these problems and also for creating an eventual democratic politics, which could be based on things like, say, peasant communities and Catholic Church organized base communities and so on. Note that it's obvious and, without a moment's thought, that for democratic politics to be meaningful, there's got to be some way for poor, disadvantaged, isolated people to have a way to pool their minimal resources to participate in the political system, even to gain information, to have ideas, to do anything. What are called secondary organizations are a prerequisite for democracy, and it looked as if that prerequisite was being developed. So that had to be wiped out. Consistent with the traditional American commitment to assuring that no democratic process can take place except the kind of democracy that they run in Albania and Poland and that we run in El Salvador and Dominican Republic. Consistent with that commitment, it was necessary to wipe out these popular organizations. And that was the main focus of the Carter War against El Salvador in 1980. And it was very successful. In the urban society, the structure of organizations was literally demolished. The university was attacked in June. The rector was killed. The libraries were destroyed. The university was dispersed. Still doesn't function. The major political dissidents were killed and assassinated by the army in November. The opposition press was wiped out. Editors were murdered or blown up and so on. So the media were wiped out. The popular organizations were wiped out. The war against the peasants began in May 1980 under the guise of land reform. And in fact, the areas of land reform were approximately those very close to those, in fact, where the army carried out its major massacres. This is, again, not accidental. One of the best ways of killing off leadership is to bring them out, you know, to form cooperatives, find out who the leadership is. Then you can go in and massacre those people and anybody who's around them and so on. So it's not surprising that, incidentally, as in Vietnam, the main attack against the peasantry began in conjunction with land reform. This was in May 1980. There were major massacres there, like the Rio Sampul massacre, all suppressed by the American press, incidentally, known from church sources immediately and published in the international press, but suppressed here for well over a year. But that's what was going on in El Salvador in 1980. At the same time, incidentally, the Salvadoran intervention in Nicaragua began in late 1979 from the Salvadoran army against the Sandinistas. And the United States began moving into Honduras and so on. This is what was going on the last year of the Carter administration. Well, that was the Human Rights Administration. And in fact, this was all very important. Notice that this prepared the prerequisites for, this made it possible to have free elections. So the basic prerequisites for democracy were, in fact, established during the Carter administration, during this last year of massacre and destruction. The popular organizations were destroyed. The opposition was killed off. The press was wiped out, the independent radio was wiped out, the archbishop was killed, and so on. All of this having been done, it was possible to turn to free elections, which we're now doing. And let me stress again that there's nothing novel about that. There's a long history of actions exactly like that in Greece and the Dominican Republic and elsewhere. This is all, people may not learn much, but ruling groups do learn. They have a historical memory, they have consciousness. They see what's worked before. They know how to do it next time. That's why you find continuity and, in fact, greater effectiveness and efficiency the next time around, even though in scholarship and the media it all looks like something new, you know, it never happened before and so on. It did. It happened before. Well, that was the Carter administration, and as I say, it laid the basis for elections that are about as meaningful as those in Albania and Poland, namely the ones that the press is now lauding, just as the Soviet press lauds elections in its domain and with exactly the same justification. They'll laud another one tomorrow. When the Reagan administration came in, it changed really two things. First of all, there was an escalation, a noticeable escalation in the Carter attack against the civilian population. It was bad enough under, probably 10,000 people were killed off in 1980. But under Reagan, it got even worse, proving that things can change, you know. And the second change, which was, again, the predictable one, was that whereas for Carter, the problem was to massacre enough people in El Salvador so that the thugs that we had put into power could control without difficulty, it was a local problem, in other words, for the Reagan administration, this was immediately placed in the context of a regional war and a conflict with the international enemy, the great Satan, the evil empire. And this comes from the reasons I already mentioned. Namely the growing commitment to militarization of the economy as a mode of industrialization and so on and so forth. So that's the Reagan changes, and it also coincided with a big increase in the construction of the Honduran military base and the increase in massacres in Guatemala and so on. Well, all of this reflects one aspect of the party line, namely our defensive role in world affairs. Now, what we find when you look, and if you look at other parts of the world, you'll find the same thing, is that the allegedly defensive role in world affairs conceals a lot. It conceals indigenous domestic initiatives for militarization, intervention, expansion, and aggression, and it shows up. The points where there's domestic militarization are also generally the points of expansion of aggression, intervention, terrorism, so on and so forth, as in these cases. Let's turn to the second element of the party line, our fabled commitment to Wilsonian self-determination, which I've already illustrated briefly in connection with the author of this doctrine, Wilson. Major U.S. intervention in Central America, minor U.S. intervention began very early. The first landing of Marines in the Dominican Republic, for example, I think was in 1800. But major military intervention in Central America began in 1854, that is 130 years ago. That was in Nicaragua. At that time, the U.S. Navy burned down and destroyed a town in Nicaragua, San Juan del Norte. The reason was that this was to avenge an insult. The insult was that a ship owned by the American millionaire Vanderbilt had landed there, and the customs officials threatened to levy port charges against it. So in response to this insult, the population was given 2 hours to evacuate, and then the town was burned down by the American Navy. That was the first major U.S. military intervention happened to be in Nicaragua. This town, incidentally, was in the news not long ago, a couple of weeks ago. It was briefly conquered by CIA-trained and backed Contras, and then they were driven out. But the press didn't bother telling you the history of the town, which is of some interest, perhaps. In the first third of this century, the U.S. sent military forces to Cuba, Panama, Mexico, and Honduras. It occupied Haiti for 20 years. It established a military dictatorship in the Dominican Republic. It invaded Nicaragua several times, again establishing military dictatorships in the Dominican Republic and Nicaragua. In the post-World War II period, there have been military interventions in Guatemala several times, in Cuba, the Dominican Republic, El Salvador, Nicaragua, Grenada. There's also been a 20-year war of terrorism against Cuba, which is undoubtedly the victim of more international terrorism than any other country in the world, possibly the victim of more international terrorism than all countries in the world combined, and therefore, according to our party line, is described as the center of international terrorism. Again, that's quite predictable. And now, in addition to all of this, there's a war against Nicaragua. Well, the impact of this has been horrendous. There's vast starvation while croplands are converted to export crops. So you get crops exported for export to the United States. You get the typical phenomenon of economic growth, hailed here by all the economists as a great miracle, and increasing starvation, which goes on at the same time, because the land is being used for export mainly to the United States, usually in connection with U.S.-based agribusiness. There's slave labor, there's crushing poverty, there's torture, mass murder. Virtually every attempt to bring about any constructive change in this U.S.-installed chamber of horrors has led to new doses of American violence. The whole record is one of the most shameful chapters of modern history, and predictably it's virtually unknown in the United States, although in a free society it would be taught in kindergarten or elementary school. There have been times, however, when U.S. officials have described what's going on in relatively frank terms, very clear, sometimes quite clearly. One put the matter in these words, I'm quoting, "The Central American area, down to and including the Isthmus of Panama, constitutes a legitimate sphere of influence for the United States. We do control the destinies of Central America, and we do so for the simple reason that the national interest absolutely dictates such a course. We must decide whether we shall tolerate the interference of any other power in Central American affairs or insist upon our own dominant position. Until now, Central America has always understood that governments that we recognize and support stay in power, while those we do not recognize and support fall. Nicaragua has become a test case. It is difficult to see how we can afford to be defeated." That's fairly familiar. These remarks were made by Undersecretary of State Robert Olds in 1927, and the outside power that he was concerned about was Mexico. Mexico at that time was a Russian proxy. It was no longer, we were no longer fighting Huns in the Dominican Republic. Now we were fighting Russians in Nicaragua, and in particular the Russian proxy, Mexico. Mexico then was a proxy of the Bolsheviks, so the Marines had to be sent in once again, and they established Somoza and established the National Guard, which was the basis for American power throughout the region, and in fact one of the most effective murder incorporated forces down there for many years. They killed Sandino. He was killed off by stealth a couple of years later, the guerrilla leader. During this period, as President Coolidge sent the Marines in, he made the following declaration. He said, "Mexico is on trial before the world." Okay, Mexico is on trial before the world as a proxy of the Soviet Union when we send the Marines into Nicaragua. Now things have changed a little bit. Now it's Nicaragua that's threatening Mexico as a Russian proxy instead of Mexico threatening Nicaragua as a Russian proxy. But again, there's the same conclusion, you know, kill the Spigs and the niggers and so on and so forth. That follows no matter who's a proxy for who, you know. And all of this is repeated, you know, with at every moment of history with great seriousness and awe and so on, as if it had some meaning. It wasn't just some black comedy. Before the Bolshevik threat, as I said, we had to defend our hemisphere from Britons and Germans and so on. Well, I've talked about that already. And before that, what did we do before that? Well, it goes way back to the colonial days. In the colonial days, we had to, quote, we had to clear the woods of those pernicious creatures to make room for a better growth, as one of our moralists, Cotton Mather, explained in colonial days. Well, Robert Olds in 1927 is by no means the only person to have given an accurate and frank account of what we're actually up to while we're, you know, showing our commitment to self-determination. There are others. Here's, for example, George Kennan, who's interesting, because he's much admired as a leading dove, and in fact that's correct. In the American context, he is a leading dove. In March 1950, when he was in the State Department, he gave a briefing for Latin American ambassadors, and U.S. ambassadors in Latin America, and he said in that briefing that the main concern of U.S. policy must be the protection of our raw materials. Notice no mincing of words here. And how do we protect our raw materials? Well, he said the final answer might be an unpleasant one, but we should not hesitate before police repression by the local government. This is not shameful, since the communists are essentially traitors. It's better to have a strong regime in power than a liberal government if it's indulgent and relaxed and penetrated by communists. Okay, that's, again, the liberal side of the spectrum. And here you have to understand that the term communist is used in its technical sense in American political discourse. Namely, it's used to refer to people who are committed to, I'm quoting now, committed to the belief that the government has direct responsibility for the welfare of the people. I was quoting there from the words of a State Department intelligence report in 1949. That was a State Department intelligence warning. I was warning about the spread of this grim and evil doctrine through Latin America and noting that it might threaten our raw materials. And therefore, we have to impose repressive and brutal governments to stop these communists, as such people have typically been called ever since, people who are committed to this doctrine. That's more or less the operational meaning of the term, however, whatever dictionary definition it has. That was with regard to Latin America. But again, remember that the United States is a global power, so we expect to find global policies and global doctrines, and we do. Here, for example, is a description of about the same time of our policy towards Asia, also by George Kennan, who was at that time the leading dove, who was at that time head of the State Department policy planning staff, and I'm now quoting from PPS 23, Policy Planning Study Number 23, written by George Kennan, February 1948, and he was thinking specifically about Asia, but the application is more broad. Here's what he had to say, and it's revealing. We have about 50% of the world's wealth, but only about 6.3% of its population. In this situation, we cannot fail to be the object of envy and resentment. Our real task in the coming period is to devise a pattern of relationships which will permit us to maintain this position of disparity. We need not deceive ourselves that we can afford today the luxury of altruism and world benefaction. We should cease to talk about vague and unreal objectives such as human rights, the raising of the living standards, and democratization. The day is not far off when we are going to deal in straight power concepts. The less we are hampered by idealistic slogans, the better. Now, of course, the idealistic slogans are still needed for the media, for a lot of scholarship, for the schools, and so on. But where the serious people are, the problem is that we have to maintain this disparity, and obviously it's got to be maintained by force. So none of the idealistic slogans at home. So when you're setting up death squads in El Salvador under the Alliance for Progress and so on, you're not hampered by these idealistic slogans. That's for the masses, for us, and so on. Well, given this kind of thinking, it's not too surprising that President Kennedy, should say, with regard to El Salvador, after supporting a military coup there, that governments of the civil-military type of El Salvador are the most effective in containing communist penetration in Latin America, this at the time when he organized the basic framework for the death squads that have been torturing and murdering ever since, and which we attribute to some kind of extreme right-wingers who somehow we can't get under control. So, for example, in the New York Times this morning, which I was reading on the plane, it says, as it always does, that human rights groups and the government agree that the murders in El Salvador are being carried out by extreme right death squads. Actually, that's not what the human rights groups agree with at all. What the human rights groups say uniformly is that the murders are being carried out by the army and the treasury police and so on, by the American-trained military units, not by some strange right-wing death squads that for some odd reason we can't get under control. And in fact, as I said, we actually set them up and have been maintaining them and providing them information and direction ever since they were set up by the Kennedy administration in El Salvador. Well, we also have to continue with all of this, and we have to continue regardless of how many are murdered, in the words of the New Republic editorialist, all, of course, in the interest of human rights for the masses, but in the interest of maintaining our resources, in the words of more rational thinkers. If there were time, I'd talk about how this applied in the rest of Asia and Latin America, but there's none. So let's turn to the third doctrine, our commitment to human rights, which became so notable in 1977 after replacing our previous commitment to self-determination as illustrated, for example, by these cases. Well, what about our commitment to human rights? Actually, that's a, you know, that's an, it's an empirical question, how American foreign policy relates to human rights. You can study it. You can study how American foreign policy changes with regard to some country as the human rights situation changes in that country. And in fact, there are a couple of studies, several studies, and they're kind of interesting. They're not too well known, but they have some interesting consequences. They in fact show that there's a striking relationship between U.S. foreign policy and human rights. One study was carried out by Lars Schultz, who's a very well-known Latin Americanist, and in fact the author of the standard scholarly work on human rights and Latin American policy, foreign policy, and a sort of a mainstream, serious, liberal Latin American scholar. He wrote an article which appeared in the journal Comparative Politics in January 1981, which was devoted precisely to studying the relationship between human rights and foreign policy in Latin America, his field. He studied a narrow concept of human rights, which are called anti-torture rights. That is, the right to be free of torture and degrading punishment and brutality and so on the part of the government. And he compared changes in the human rights climate in that sense, anti-torture rights, with American aid, and he found the correlation. I'll quote from his conclusions. U.S. aid has tended to flow disproportionately to Latin American governments which torture their citizens. It has tended to flow disproportionately to the hemisphere's relatively egregious violators of the fundamental human rights. Now, you might think that this is just a sort of a byproduct of our commitment to human needs. Somehow, the governments committed to human needs are the ones that are torturing their citizens. So he looked into that, and he found that human needs were uncorrelated with American aid policy. So no correlation with aid, but a very good correlation with torture, murder, brutality, death squads, and so on. He also found out that the correlation was quite strong, that it included military aid, and that it extended through the Carter period. So there is then a definite relation between U.S. foreign policy and human rights, and there's a certain sense in which Arthur Schlesinger was telling the truth when he said that human rights is replacing self-determination as the guiding value in our foreign policy. That is, to the exact extent that we were committed to self-determination, we were also committed to human rights, as this correlation shows. Well, a correlation isn't a theory, you know. You can't conclude from the correlation that we give aid to a country because we like it when they torture their citizens. I mean, it's true, we do give aid to countries when they do torture their citizens, but that a correlation is not a, you know, is not a causal relation. So you got to look deeper to find a causal relation. And in fact, one of the other studies that was carried out does offer an explanation. This was carried out by Edward Herman, who's an economist at the University of Pennsylvania and a co-author of mine occasionally, has written a number of very important things in this area. And one of the things that he did was carry out a study of the correlation between U.S. foreign policy and human rights. And he'd used slightly different indices than Schultz, and he also, it was worldwide, not Latin America, but he essentially found the same correlation. That is, the more the human rights climate deteriorates in some country, the more we give it aid. Okay, that's very close correlation. So that's essentially the same result. Similar study was carried out by Mike Clare with somewhat different techniques, but essentially the same result. Now, Herman went on to do a second study, which gives some more insight into this. He carried out a study of the correlation between American aid and changes in the investment climate in particular countries. So you look at, that was measured by things like, say, laws permitting repatriation of profits and so on, and, you know, cutting down taxes for international corporations, things of that kind. And again, he found a very good correlation. That is, as the investment climate improves, American aid goes up. Okay, now given these two correlations, you can immediately see what's going on. Now we have a theory. It doesn't take much thought to figure it out. American foreign policy is overwhelmingly determined by the needs of investors, naturally. I mean, they're the ones who run the government and largely staff it and hold the external power. So obviously, foreign policy reflects their interests. And the needs of investors are for a favorable investment climate. So therefore, of course, we'll give aid to countries that improve the investment climate. To put it a little more crudely, countries that allow us to rob them at will, we'll give foreign aid to. That's natural. That's to be expected. And in fact, there's documentary evidence to explain the reasons, such things as those I quoted, and there's a long history showing that this works. So that correlation we expect. Well, now what about the other correlation? Well, see, that's also expected, because there's a very close and natural relationship between improvement of the investment climate and deterioration of the human rights climate. That is, if you want to improve the investment climate in some country, the best way of doing it is to murder union leaders, murder priests who are organizing among the peasants, destroy cooperatives, wipe out any opposition press that might be talking about using resources for your own needs, and in general, attacking the kind of people who are communists in our special sense, that is, who think that the government ought to be concerned with the welfare of its own population instead of the welfare of Big Brother, the obviously transcendent interest. So you expect then a correlation between deterioration of the human rights climate and improvement of the investment climate, and given those facts, we have a rather natural explanation for what's going on. American policy is overwhelmingly determined by questions of investment climate and the like, and a consequence of that in countries like those in our domains is brutality, murder, torture, and so on. So therefore, there's a correlation noted in the earlier study between deterioration in the human rights climate and increase in American aid. In short, we do not support and aid countries because we like the murder of priests and the decapitation of peasant leaders and so on and so forth. Rather, that's irrelevant, basically. That's not relevant. There are higher needs, those that I mentioned from earlier documents. And given that commitment to the higher needs, if this follows, well, it just follows. Now, that's an interesting finding. It ought to, you know, as I say, it's not exactly what you learn in elementary school or anywhere else. And in fact, not only is the conclusion suppressed, though it seems a rather important one, but the data relating to it is suppressed. So, for example, there the articles, say, by Lars Schultz, who's a major Latin Americanist in a mainstream journal, is not, you know, very well known. It's not on every reading list in your courses, I suppose, though it ought to be because it's very enlightening. And similarly, with respect to the other studies that I noted mentioned, similarly, the main facts are suppressed. Like, there aren't many people who know that since we overturned the democratic government of Guatemala in 1954 with a CIA-backed military coup, human rights groups estimate that about 145,000 people have been murdered. That's not well known. Or take January 1981 again, the month when Lars Schultz's article appeared. Some other things happened in that month. For example, there was a conference in Costa Rica in January 1981. It was called the Conference of the Disappeared. Disappearance is a technique invented by the Nazis. The idea is that the murderers come in and people just are gone, never hear from them again. Sometimes you'll find a piece of them in a ditch or something, but usually you never hear from them again. Now, that Nazi technique was picked up and elaborated and extended by our clients, our various Himmlers that we establish in Latin America, and it became a plague again in the 1960s and 70s. It very closely correlated to the countries that are American clients, incidentally, like Guatemala. So there was a conference that disappeared in Costa Rica in January 1981, and, you know, mothers of people, kids who disappeared and that sort of thing. They calculated, the figures that they gave were that 90,000 people had disappeared that they knew of, were disappeared, as the term is used. That is, eliminated somehow, never heard from again, by the state terrorists who were in power. That's a fair amount. There was not a word about it in the American press, incidentally. Now, you know, if there had been, let's say, a conference in Paris of 90,000 of people who disappeared in, say, Eastern Europe, with 90,000 people and, you know, mothers talking about what happened and so on, chances are it might have made the press, in fact, maybe more. Maybe it would have even been treated like KL007. In fact, it's far more serious than that. But here there was not a word, because, of course, these are the people who are disappeared in our domains, and therefore they don't exist. You know? We don't know about them, so that fact is kept quiet. Meanwhile, there was much wailing about international terrorism, which is the great scourge that's, you know, wiping out civilization and is directed from Cuba or something like that. A further point that ought to be noted is that these correlations that I've discussed between human rights and American foreign policy, they actually understate rather seriously the real correlation. And the reason is because they're restricted to a narrow concept of human rights. See, in the American version of human rights, it is really restricted to anti-torture rights. But in the world, in the international conventions and so on, human rights has quite a much broader meaning. For example, human rights is understood outside the United States to mean things like, for example, the right to work, or the right to health, or the right to food. What we might briefly call the right to live, that's considered a human right outside the United States. But in the United States, it's not. These are typically excluded in American treatments of human rights, and here we consider only anti-torture rights. If you look at the broader context of human rights, the correlation between human rights and American foreign policy will become even worse, even more shameful. In the regions that are under direct American control, the human rights climate in the general sense, meaning including the right to live, is too horrible to discuss. In fact, we can take, say Guatemala. In 1954, again, this was one of the most promising countries of the hemisphere. There was a New Deal-style democratically elected administration, which was carrying out constructive development. It was really beginning to deal with some of the problems of Guatemala, with considerable progress, incidentally. So therefore, of course, it had to be overthrown by the CIA coup. The overthrow was called by John Foster Dulles, who was Secretary of the State at the time. He called this a new and glorious chapter in the already great traditions of the American states. That was 1954. We can now look at what happened in that new and glorious chapter. By now, about 80% of the agricultural population lives under conditions described as virtual slavery by the London Anti-Slavery Society in a recent publication. About 50,000 children die every year of malnutrition. As I mentioned before, the population starves while croplands are devoted to export. People sell their blood in order to live. Much of the blood in the American market comes from people selling their blood in Guatemala. Doctors say that they sell it up to the point where they die. You know, they sell the last bit of blood and then they die. Incidentally, this used to happen in Nicaragua too, but the Sandinistas put an end to it. That was one of the interferences with free enterprise that's greatly, you know, causes great outrage here. There used to be a free market in blood in Nicaragua, and there isn't anymore under Somoza. This also happens in places like Brazil, except in Brazil they not only sell their blood, but they also advertise their eyes and kidneys for sale in the newspapers in order to try to live. This, incidentally, is the result of another economic miracle, which was caused by the first major coup backed by Kennedy and then by Johnson in Latin America, namely the Brazilian coup of 1964, basis laid in the Kennedy administration, actually carried out after his assassination. And that's important. Brazil is a powerful country. What happens there has a domino effect, and it did have a domino effect when a national security state run by terror and torture murderers backed by the United States was established in Brazil. This also was described here by Kennedy's ambassador and Johnson's Undersecretary of State. It was Lincoln Gordon. It was described as the greatest victory for freedom in the mid-20th century. That's what happens in Brazil. There was an economic miracle, much lauded here, with consequences of the sort that I've described. The nature of those consequences should really be appreciated. A Brazilian friend recently sent me copies of a Brazilian scientific journal, which had some statistics about Rio de Janeiro. Rio de Janeiro, incidentally, is not the poor part of the country. That's sort of the rich part of the country. It's not the northeast, you know, where 35 million people or so are Nobody knows what happens to them or cares. But Rio de Janeiro, that's the, where people are looking, the rich parts. And this journal was a science, it's a science journal, kind of like Science in the United States. And it had some figures. It was studying malnutrition. And here's the figures it had for Rio de Janeiro. Infants from 0 to 5 months, severe malnutrition, meaning medically severe, 67%. 5 months to a year, 41% severe malnutrition. A year to 5 years, 11% severe malnutrition. Now, the reason, of course, for the decline from 67 to 41 to 11 is they've all died. So that's what happens under the conditions of the economic miracle, like in Guatemala. Now, it's a little wrong to say that the people die. The fact is they don't die. We kill them. That's what happens. We kill them by supporting, by carrying out policies supporting the regimes of the kind that I've described, and by intervening with force and violence to suppress and destroy any attempt, however minimal, even on a speck like Grenada, however minimal, we've got to stop any attempt to bring some change into this. That's the history of our hemisphere, as indicated by these examples. Or again, in Guatemala, we overthrew the democratic government in 1954. In 1963, there was a threat that there might be another democratic election, and that Arevalo, who was the most the main sort of democratic leader, might run and certainly win. So the Kennedy administration intervened again to back a military coup to ensure that there wouldn't be any democratic election there. That is, the prerequisites for democracy had not yet been fully established in Guatemala. So we had to support another military coup. In the late 60s, Green Berets and American planes based in Panama were directly involved in massacres there to suppress a guerrilla movement which arose as a result of all of this. Maybe 8 or 10,000 people were killed. This went on through the 70s. In 1977, Congress put some constraints on direct military aid to countries like Guatemala. That's what's called here the Carter Human Rights Policy for some reason. There were congressional constraints on sending military aid to Guatemala. So we therefore had to turn to surrogate states, Argentina and primarily Israel in this case, which is the main arms supplier of the Guatemalan neo-Nazis since 1977. And there maybe that's the country that's probably most like Nazi Germany in the world, I suppose, anyway, pretty close. Incidentally, while it's commonly stated here that American aid to Guatemala stopped in 1977, that's false. In fact, American military aid barely changed. When you look at the Pentagon printouts, you find that military aid continued at approximately the normal level through various mechanisms in the period of the alleged aid cutoff. So that was Guatemala, and let me say then, as in Brazil, that they don't die, we kill them. Well, I could go on and would like to go on to talk about other parts of the world, but there's no time. Let me finish, finally, emphasizing what I think is the main point that we ought to bear in mind. The real victims of the policies we conduct in Latin America and in much of the rest of the world, the real victims are the millions of brutalized, tortured people throughout much of the third world. Now, we have a very highly effective ideological system, and it prevents us from seeing any of this. Our institutions protect us from all of this, except very sporadically and in a very misleading way, as if they were isolated phenomena or some sort of odd consequences of our unique benevolence or something of that kind. Now, this is a very important topic, rarely studied, just as the main drift of American history is rarely studied, and one that's certainly worth commenting on in itself, but I won't have time. If we had the honesty and the moral courage, what we would do, we would not let a day pass without listening to the cries of the victims. And by that I mean we would turn on the radio in the morning, and as we wake up, we would hear, let's say, a report from Quiche province in Guatemala, where a couple of refugees who straggled out can tell the story of how the Guatemalan army entered, drove all the population in a village into the town center, then took the men out and beheaded them, raped and killed all the women, took the children and took them out to the nearby river and bashed their heads against the rocks and killed them. That's what we'd hear in the morning. And then later in the day, we'd listen to the huge flood of reports from refugees, from Amnesty International, from Survival International, from America's Watch, from all the mainstream human rights organizations, which have just poured out an immense flow of horrors on this subject, but we very successfully managed to insulate ourselves from all of this. This whole grim reality is something we don't hear about. We're insulated. We can be happy and cheerful. By so doing, we sink to a level of moral depravity that really has very few counterparts in the modern world. And we also help to fan the flames that will lead to a conflagration that sooner or later will engulf us as well. Okay. Yeah. So what kind of correlations are there between American foreign policy and our own domestic problems? Well, as far as I know, there have been no direct studies of that, but you sort of know what to look for. I mean, for example, there have been studies that relate militarization of the economy to domestic economic problems. And, well, for example, there's some discussion of that in Seymour Melman's recent book, Profits Without Production, and other sources. And what it shows is sort of what you'd expect, that military Keynesianism as an industrial planning program has very selective effects. I mean, it does give jobs to highly trained people, and it supports advanced industry. So, for example, take, say, computers. We pretend here that Japan, that in Japan the state is intervening in the economy, but here it's free enterprise. Actually, it's more or less the same, they're just slightly different mechanisms. So, say, take computers, which are sort of a main element of, the technologically advanced economy. In the 1950s, virtually all the funding for research and development and also virtually all purchases of computers were from the military. In the 1960s, it went down to about 50%. And today, for example, today we're, trying to meet the Japanese challenge with what's called a fifth-generation computer, supercomputer, huge program with billions and billions of dollars. It's being done through the Pentagon, NASA, which is really military-oriented, despite what they say, and the Department of Energy, which is also a military department. It's the department that builds nuclear weapons and so on and so forth. So we use the military system to support what's called sometimes sunrise industry. And that has its particular effect. It means that we end up with an economy, there's a tendency towards an economy with a lot of money for managers and so on and owners and so on in centralized high technology sector of the economy, and also some for skilled workers. But then for the rest, it becomes a service economy. A lot of people either unemployed or serving McDonald's and that kind of stuff. And you can see it. You can see it in the statistics. I mean, it's what they call these days the decline of the middle class, meaning the relative decline of the middle income sectors with the increase in wealth for the super rich, or the top 5% or something, and a big increase in the poorer sectors. And of course, it also means that the basic structure of our economy just deteriorates. I mean, computers and all that sort of thing, it's okay, but that's not what people need to live. What you need to live is other things, and the other things disappear. Now, here there is, in fact, a serious, significant difference between our system and the Japanese system. So the Japanese system does have direct state intervention in the economy. There's an institution, MITI, Ministry of International Trade and Industry, which coordinates industrial policy planning. It brings together the main sectors of Japanese industry. It brings them together. They make plans and so on and so forth, just as our system does through the Pentagon. But they don't do it through the military system. They do it oriented towards the commercial market. So their industrial planning system, which involves state centralization, as every modern system does, is oriented toward the commercial market, and ours is oriented towards waste production, which is basically what the military system is. Now, there are good historical reasons for that, but the net effect is obvious. The net effect is that they wipe us out of competition. So we produce better than they do. Our waste production is much superior to theirs. Like we produce, you know, more fancy jet planes and bigger missiles and all that kind of stuff, but they produce better things that sell. And that's not because of something in the genes, it's because of institutional structures. So there is a very clear, and so for example, well, take today, under the, see here there's a difference between Reagan and Kennedy. The Reagan and Kennedy programs, as I mentioned, are very similar. And that tells you something about the real spectrum of politics in the United States, incidentally. The Kennedy administration, if you pull aside the rhetoric and you look at its programs, it consisted of regressive fiscal measures to support new investment, what we call now supply-side economics. That was really the only domestic program. There was one other. The other major domestic program was the big buildup of the military under McNamara. And then the international policies were search for international confrontation. Kennedy administration practically got us into a nuclear war about maybe three times in the first 2 years, and then it backed off a little, and a lot of aggression. So invasion of South Vietnam, Cuba, the whole, what I described in Latin America, and so on. And that's like Reagan. But there was a difference. During the Kennedy period, this probably had a, you know, what you might call a beneficial effect on the economy. That is, the economy also grew. Under the Reagan administration, this really isn't happening. There's what they call recovery, but it's recovery from a big recession. They're hoping now that the number of unemployed at the time of the election will be the same as it was when Reagan came in. And meanwhile, during this big buildup of the recovery, incidentally, was led by military industry. While the recovery is going on, it's okay for, you know, very relatively rich people or people connected with high tech or something. But meanwhile, you know, we are, I suppose, the only industrial society, the only advanced industrial society, where there are plenty of people dying of starvation in the streets, you know, or in places like Boston, where it's cold in the winter, sleeping in the streets, you know, mothers and children and so on, thousands and thousands. Nobody really knows how many because, you know, these people don't count. They're like peasants in Central America. They're not real people. But that's going on at the same time, and that wasn't a concomitant of the Kennedy policies, not because the Kennedy liberals were somehow more humane, but because the world has changed. At that period, in 1960, the United States really was the world dominant power. I mean, we were just overwhelmingly dominant in economic and security and other dimensions. Now it's less true. Now, for all sorts of reasons, we're still the most powerful country, we don't control things. Like, the world is more complex. Both the United States and the Soviet Union have suffered a reduction in their power to coerce, though they increase in absolute power. And this means there are a lot of things that could be done easily in the early 60s that can't be done today. So just to give one index, in the early 60s, the Kennedy administration was concerned over the viability of the Japanese economy. They were afraid it was unviable, and they were trying to figure out some way to keep it going and so on. That's not Reagan's problem today. And that's one, you know, that's one indication of the change that's taken place. That's why the commitment to waste production as our industrial planning system, which is about what it amounts to, has very deleterious effects today in a way in which it didn't 20 years ago. So I think that way you can really find the correlation. Yeah?
Yeah, what can people do here, and how important is, like, mass direct action and civil disobedience and stopping intervention?
That's really the most important question of all. What can be done about it all? And I think, you know, it's not a big secret. I think we all know what can be done about it all. We may choose not to do what can be done, but we know what to do. I mean, we know from our own recent experience. So, for example, let's compare again the early 1980s with the early 1960s. Okay? Two very similar administrations came into power. They did very similar things. Let's look at the problem that the Kennedy liberals faced, say, in Indochina, which was their main concern in about 1961. In 1954, you don't mind a little history, let's put this in because it's very similar to what's going on in Central America today, and we can learn, you know, not only ruling groups can learn from history, other people can too if they pay attention. In 1954, we moved in to try to prevent a political settlement after the French had left, and then a political settlement was arranged. We had to move in to undermine it, and we did. The next 6 years in South Vietnam were like what's been going on in Central America for the last couple of years. That is, for the next 6 years, a basically mercenary American army was established in South Vietnam, which was set to massacring the population. That was so-called the miracle of, you know, the Diem miracle, and all kind of names for it. But it was just a massacre. So, for example, you know, like Bernard Fall, who's a big hawk, incidentally, and a military specialist and so on, he calculated the number of people killed then at about 80,000 in those years. It's a lot, you know. Meanwhile, the main attack at that time was against the anti-French resistance, what we here call the Viet Cong, basically the anti-French resistance, which we recognized and had always recognized to be the nationalist movement in the South. So the main purpose was kind of like Carter in El Salvador, try to wipe out the nationalist movement, and then, you know, you can have free elections and all that sort of nice stuff. That's what was going on in the late 60s, and there was no resistance. Interestingly, there was no resistance because at that time, the nationalist movement, what we call the communists, were committed to trying to get the international agreements established. They hoped that there would be some way to realize the international settlement proposed at Geneva in 1954. By 1959, they'd been virtually decimated. The Viet Cong, so-called, had been virtually decimated, and they were then authorized to use force and self-defense. Well, as soon as they were authorized to use force and self-defense, the American established client government collapsed because it was really based on nothing except a monopoly of violence. And once it no longer had a monopoly of violence, it just fell apart. That's called here North Vietnamese aggression or Russian aggression or something like that, namely the right of the people who are being attacked to defend themselves. Same in El Salvador, incidentally. If you know, we have a big argument here about whether Nicaragua and Cuba are sending arms to El Salvador. Well, I don't know. You know, so far there's no evidence that they are. But that's not really the interesting question. I mean, you know, you've got to watch the way questions are framed by the propaganda system. The way it's framed is the doves say they're not sending arms and the hawks say they are sending arms. But the real question, which is being suppressed in all of this, is should they be sending arms? And the answer is, of course, yes. Everybody should be sending arms. We shouldn't. See that question is not raised. Just as if we were having, you know, if somebody was talking in, say, the Soviet Union, and the question came up, should somebody send arms to Afghan rebels? Well, of course not. You know, that's terrorism or something like that. So here, the point is that it's perfectly legitimate to send arms to people who finally try to use violence and self-defense against a gang of mass murderers installed by foreign power. Of course it's legitimate to send them arms. Chances are nobody's doing it. And they're not doing it not because it's wrong to do it, but because they're just intimidated. You don't get in the way of a rogue elephant, you know. And you don't mess around with the United States. So therefore people probably aren't sending them arms. That's the way the question sort of ought to be put. Anyhow, in 1959, the so-called Viet Cong were given authorization to use force and self-defense. The government system collapsed, just as what's happening in El Salvador now. And the Kennedy administration came in. They had to make a decision. And what they decided to do was to carry out the direct attack against South Vietnam. Now, that's an event that doesn't exist in American history. In American history, there is no such event as the American attack against South Vietnam, just as in, say, Russian history, there's no such event as the Russian invasion of Afghanistan. They have a thing called the Russian Defense of Afghanistan against international terrorists and so on, aided from abroad. And we have a thing called the Defense of South Vietnam against international terrorists aided from abroad. But the fact is that with even more validity it's unfair to the Russians to make this comparison, I should say. But in the case of Vietnam, we just invaded the country in 1961. 1961 and 62 is when the American Air Force began its direct participation, that means American pilots and American planes, in large-scale bombing of the peasants of South Vietnam, which at that time was 85% of the population. And the goal at that time was to try to drive several million of them into what we called strategic hamlets, actually concentration camps surrounded by barbed wire, where they were supposed to be free to choose their own representatives without the interference of the Viet Cong, who we admitted they voluntarily supported. Now, that's called an invasion when some other country does it. When somebody starts, you know, when some power starts carrying out massive bombing of another country, and in this case also defoliation and, you know, concentration of the population in concentration camps and so on and so forth, that's called an invasion. But in our case, since we did it, it's called a defense, okay? That happened in 1961, and it then expanded into a bigger invasion and so on and so forth. All right, why is that? And that's the problem that Reagan's facing. Similar situation. In fact, he was facing it in 1981. Now, if you notice, there was a different reaction. In 1981, the Reagan administration did not invade South Vietnam, El Salvador. They certainly wanted to. I don't think there's any doubt that they wanted to. They were gearing up for it. As soon as they came in, they were gearing up for a direct invasion, and they've been trying to get American troops in there ever since, both against El Salvador and against Nicaragua. And they're sort of slowly managing it, you know. Like, for example, the participation of U.S. Air Force pilots in direct control of bombing and ground operations, okay, that sort of insinuates the American forces in there a little more. But what's interesting, and that gets back to the question what you can do, is that the Kennedy administration had no problem. You know, they could, if they wanted to invade South Vietnam in 1961, they just did it. There was no protest, you know, couldn't get two people together in a room to talk about it. And in fact, as late as the real history of this is worth remembering. It was, as take a city like Boston, which is a pretty liberal city, as late as the spring of 1966, when we had about 200,000 troops in there, you couldn't hold a public meeting to oppose the war because it would be broken up by students with the applause of the press, you know. That's as late as the spring of 66, you know. And then we had a couple hundred thousand troops in there, you know. We'd already extended the war to the rest of Indochina and so on. But now they can't do it, you know. And they, so the Reagan administration came in with immediate plans to do what Kennedy did in the early 60s, similar situation, do the same thing, and they've been unable to do it. They're sort of slowly, you know, what they're doing is bad enough, but what they're doing is sort of a continuation of what the United States did in South Vietnam in the late 50s, and what, say, Carter did in El Salvador. That is, what they're doing is trying to control the population through massacre, but without extensive participation of the American forces, and they probably can't continue that much longer because we have a mercenary army there, and it probably won't hold. Mercenary forces just don't fight very well. That's an old message. They don't fight like the people we call guerrillas, that is, people fighting to defend their homes and so on and so forth. They fight differently. Consequently, it's likely that they will have to send American troops, and they've felt that for several years. When the White Paper came out in February 1981, it was an effort, it was surely an attempt to build a basis for sending the troops. Well, they couldn't do it because of a thing called the Vietnam Syndrome. That's a dread disease that afflicted a large part of the American population, finally, in the late 60s and the 70s. And the disease is manifested in such symptoms as opposition to massacre and aggression and things like that. And it's interesting that it's called syndrome, you know, sort of something, you know, has to be cured somehow. And they haven't yet found a way to cure it. You know. That means that and that showed up in early 1981. It showed up very clearly. There was spontaneous opposition developed all over the country from all sorts of sources, from, you know, popular, you know, from solidarity groups to church groups to people writing to their congressmen to all sorts of things showed up. And it's been going on ever since in all sorts of ways. I mean, take sanctuaries, which you don't find much in places like Boston because that's an elite, ideologically advanced, educated, and cultured community where you support the party line without question. But you do find it in other parts of the country where people are less civilized and educated and they don't understand, you know, these things and so on. And that's important, you know, and it's so broad and widespread that it's hard to suppress. And in fact, you know, the nature of the Vietnam Syndrome is rather accurately revealed, I think, by some polls which are certainly taken to heart in the government. So, for example, one national poll about a year ago indicated that more than half the population of the United States said that they would support direct resistance if the United States put troops in El Salvador. Now, there was nothing remotely like that during the Vietnam War. I mean, not even, you could, I mean, it was statistically undetectable, the proportion that would support resistance. And this is important. Now, the question, of course, it's not enough to have the feeling. That is useless. They don't care what feelings you have. What's important is to do something about it. And what you can do about it, well, I mean, here we can, we recognize that we live in a, I mean, we live in a society which is extremely violent with regard to its international behavior, but it's relatively nonviolent with regard to its domestic upper middle classes, at least. So for the privileged part of the population in the United States, the state uses relatively little violence to control them, controls them in other ways, but not violence. People like us, you know, are not subjected to intense government violence. On the world scale, it's less than most places. It's different if you're poor, you know. But I'm talking about people like us. That's just a fact, and that means that there's a range of options open, and that range of options stretches from, you know, from making a nuisance of yourself to your congressman to becoming involved in direct resistance. There's a whole range of options that are open that are not available in societies that, except to heroes, in societies that, that resort to violence to suppress dissent. So there's a lot that, that you can do, and I think everybody knows what it is. You know, what you have to do is raise the cost of aggression. Now, there are a lot of ways of raising the cost of aggression, and if you look back, it's worth studying what caused the American leadership to decide in 1968 that it wasn't worthwhile sending a couple hundred thousand more troops to Vietnam and, you know, trying to win a major victory. Well, what made them decide in early 1968, and incidentally that reflected itself in the press about a year later, when the press started criticizing the war and in scholarship about a year later and so on. But when business circles turned against the war in early 68, they did it because they regarded the domestic costs as too high. And the domestic costs were disruption, for example. They want, what if you own the country, you know, what you want is a placid, obedient population. You don't want any fuss, you know. You don't want people to make a nuisance of themselves, to organize, to ask too much, to, you know, you don't want even cultural disorder. And all of this was measured. In fact, when the Joint Chiefs were asked whether they would approve of sending 200,000 more troops to Vietnam and South Vietnam in 1968, one of the reasons they opposed it was they said they thought they'd need them for civil disorder control. That's important. I mean, what it meant is that the effect of the war was building up a level of dissidence that was dangerous. Was dangerous. In fact, there's another problem that developed in that period. And again, ruling circles pay attention to it. Population doesn't much, but we should. And there's, aside from the Vietnam syndrome, there's another terrible thing that happened in the late 60s. It also has a technical name. It's called the crisis of democracy. That also developed at that period. And it's worth studying the way that's perceived by elite groups. In fact, there's a book called The Crisis of Democracy, which you really ought to read very carefully. It was published in 1975 by the Trilateral Commission, which is sort of the liberal wing of the international ruling capitalist ruling elite, the one that put back Carter. The American Contribution is written by Samuel Huntington, who's a professor of well-known liberal professor of political science at Harvard. And it's trilateral, that means Europe, United States, and Japan, and all of them talked about the crisis of democracy. And it's very intriguing. You learn the answer to what you can do, in part, by seeing what they regard as a crisis. See, what they regard as a crisis is, of course, things like, you know, the kind of disorders that require troops for civil disorder control, but other things are also a crisis. In fact, the main crisis of democracy that they noticed there was simply that there was the beginning of political organization among large parts of the population, literally. You have to read this. I mean, you shouldn't believe what I say. You should look it up and see it in their own words. They said that in the 60s, there was the beginning of organization among usually passive groups of the population. So young people, ethnic groups, women, you know, all kind of groups in the population that are usually just passive and obedient and just do what they're told and so on, began to enter into the political arena. You know, they became organized. That's the kind of thing we got to stop. Now, if it's El Salvador, the way we stop it is by mass murder. That's what was happening. They were also getting a crisis of democracy in El Salvador in the 70s. So then we had to move in and wipe out the organizations. So that crisis was put down, and now we can have elections. Well, as I say, in the United States, you don't do that against the privileged part of the population. You do it against other parts, but not against the privileged part of the population. So you couldn't handle the crisis in that way. And they had to figure out other ways to solve the crisis, and to solve it meant to restore the population to apathy, passivity, and obedience. Okay, that would overcome the crisis of democracy. Incidentally, this gives you a very... This partially answers the question what you can do. Of course, what you can do is try to make the crisis of democracy worse. You know, that is, really begin to develop organization and participation in the political system for the first time. That's one thing that can be done, and that just is, you know, creating the problems that caused them to need a couple hundred thousand troops for civil disorder control is another thing that can be done, and sort of anything in between. But what's particularly interesting about this is what it reveals about not only the answers that it gives to what you can do, and it means a lot, but it also gives you a very clear idea of the concept of democracy that's held by people with power. Here, we know what they mean for El Salvador and Guatemala and Nicaragua and so on. It means that first you murder and wipe out all the popular opposition, and you destroy the press, and you kill the priests, and so on. And then you let people go to polls where they're allowed to put pieces of paper into transparent voting boxes. If you look in the paper, you'll notice that whenever there's a picture, they're always transparent. That's by law in El Salvador, something which the observers didn't seem to happen to notice. And so they're allowed to put pieces of paper into a transparent voting box when a member of the army, meaning the death squads, is standing there looking at them. And of course, after the political opposition has been wiped out and the main opposition is not allowed to run and the press has been destroyed and so on. That's the way you carry out democracy. And very much the same concept is held for the mother country itself. So the problem of that's why it was a crisis when people began to organize politically, you know, to participate in the political system. And the concept of democracy that's held really in both cases is, in a way, kind of reminiscent of the feudal system. I mean, the picture of our elites, and this is our liberal elites, the picture is that it's sort of as if there's a nobility, you know, which basically owns things, like the king and the nobles, they basically own everything. And then there are the commoners. That's, you know, everybody else, most everybody. And since the nobility is kind of benevolent and really good-hearted, if the commoners come to them with pleas and requests, they can sometimes agree to it. You know, of course, assuming that nothing fundamentally changes in the structure of power and wealth and so on and privilege. But the benevolent nobility can sometimes respond to the commoners. But suppose too many commoners begin to make pleas. Well, then you got a crisis. Then you have a crisis. If the commoners are asking too much, you can't respond without changing the structure of power and privilege, and of course that's out. So you have a crisis, and you got to do something about it. What you got to do is either use violence if you have that kind of society, or find some other way to shut them up if you have a different kind of society. And that's essentially the concept of democracy held by the liberal elites here. In El Salvador, we can use violence to shut them up. Here, we got to use other means of cultural and ideological control. And the way you can act to resist this is simply to extend the crisis of democracy and, you know, meaning develop continuing popular organizations that will continue. They won't just be oriented toward a particular issue and then disappear when that issue gets off the front pages, but will continue to deal with a range of issues, you know, the whole range of integrated issues, and will participate actively in the political system, and will go all the way over to direct civil disobedience, which is certainly legitimate. No doubt that civil disobedience is often legitimate. We know everybody agrees that it's often legitimate. The question is when, and you have to make judgments there about the nature of the violence you're confronting and the means that are available to confront it and so on. But it seems to me those are the things that can be done, you know, and we know from our experience what they are. We also know how ruling groups think about them, which is important. Well, the media's treatment of the Korean airliner, that was a beautiful case, actually, of orchestrated propaganda control. Well, remember what happened. Let me remind you of what happened. On September 1st of last year, the Soviet Union shot down Korean KAL-07, killing 269 people. And this was the immediate response here was this proved that the Russians are the most barbaric people since, you know, Attila the Hun or something, and therefore we have to step up the attack against Nicaragua, build the MX missiles, put Pershings in West Germany, and increase the military system. In fact, the immediate main reaction here was great euphoria on Wall Street, where commentators pointed out that defense stocks had never looked better, you know, the big rise in defense stocks. All of this was because of this barbarous act, which is the worst thing that ever happened in human history. Well, and, you know, the original story, the story was given unbelievable coverage. Not only the story, but the American government interpretation of it, which is roughly what I just said, was given the kind of coverage that I doubt has ever been given to any story in history. I mean, haven't had a chance to really do the research, but I don't remember any like it. Just to give you an indication, the New York Times publishes an index volume. If you've ever looked at it, the index volume is a very densely printed thing. You practically need a magnifying glass to read it. Big pages, you know, densely published thing. For the month of September alone, the index volume is 7 pages, okay, just on this. Now, you might carry out a research project and ask if there's ever been a story that's gotten that coverage. And it's all from the standpoint of the government. namely here these unbelievable monsters for no reason other than sadistic love of massacre, killed 269 innocent people. Well, the government story gradually eroded and collapsed, and now basically nothing's left of it, except some funny questions, like, you know, what was that Korean airliner actually doing over the most sensitive area of Russian airspace, and why didn't the American reconnaissance jets, the RC-135s or E-4s or whatever they were nearby, which are sort of indistinguishable from them, why didn't they signal to the plane, as they certainly had the ability to do, to get out of the region, you know? And what was it doing there in the first place? I mean, how come it was on a great circle route? You know, it's very hard to imagine by a navigational error. There are all kind of questions like that, and those questions have essentially collapsed the government case, as was sort of quietly admitted in the small print after the political capital had been made. But there's some other things which are never discussed, which I think are even more important. So let me mention a couple. Right in the middle of all of this furor about the Korean airliner, on November 11th, in fact, there was a 100-word item in the New York Times, 100 words. This is compared with this, you know, I mean, huge coverage of the Korean airliner. There was 100 words devoted to the interesting fact that UNITA, which is a group that we call freedom fighters, supported by us in South Africa, in Angola, so the freedom fighters that we support along with South Africa, they took credit for shooting down a civilian Angolan jet, killing 126 people. Now, there was no RC-135 in the area, confusing the issue, maybe jamming radar or something like that. It was just pure, plain, unpremeditated murder. You know, got 100 words in the New York Times. February 9th this year, UNITA took credit for downing another civilian jet. That one wasn't even mentioned. You got to read the foreign press to find that one out. Now, you know, under the very confused circumstances of KAL-07, if that was the worst atrocity in human history, well, what about the freedom fighters we support along with South Africa, who did something much worse? You know, they just purposely shot down a civilian jet. I mean, granted, the only people killed were black or something, but putting that aside, why is it any different? You know, in fact, it's a lot worse. And in fact, since we're the ones that support them, we're the worst barbarians in history, way worse than the Russians. So let's go back a little further. Those who have a little bit of memory will remember some other cases. For example, in October 1976, a Cubana airliner was blown up with 76 people killed, including the Olympic gold medal winning fencing team of Cuba. And that the bomb was placed on the plane by the CIA. You know, it was placed by a CIA agent. He's known. I mean, he continued to be a CIA agent, continued to carry out other atrocities. Okay, so the CIA blew up a Cuban civilian airliner in October 1976. This is one small piece of the major war of international terrorism that we wage against Cuba mainly, but also against other countries, which is not called terrorism here because we do it, so therefore it's not terrorism. But there's another one. Or let's go back a little further. In February 1973, Israel, which is again our client state, shot down a jet plane, civilian jet, over the Sinai, killing 110 people. The plane was lost in a sandstorm. It was about 2 minutes flight time away from Cairo. There was no sensitive military, I mean, nothing, no confusion, no ambiguity. The orders came from the highest center of the high command, shot it down. Now, this was sort of noticed. You know, there were a couple of references to this in the middle of the KAL-07 business. And so, predictably, a series of lies were produced in the New York Times and elsewhere, saying that that the situation was totally different because Israel had taken responsibility and paid compensation. If you look back, you find that Israel did not take responsibility and refused to pay compensation. That's what in fact happened. What they did was they agreed to something else, what's called ex gratia compensation, meaning just sort of pure humanitarian aid, which is easy enough because we pay for it. But they refused to pay compensation because that would imply responsibility, and they refused any responsibility. In fact, what they did was exactly what the Russians did. They put a couple of pilots on television, and they told how what they did was exactly right and just, and they tried to blame the French pilot. He didn't know how to fly, and so on and so forth. That's what happened. A couple of days after that, Golda Meir came to Washington, okay, premier of Israel. She was about 4 days later. She was asked no embarrassing questions about this. Press didn't bother her. And she returned home with new military aircraft. Okay, that's the way we responded in that case. There was also editorial comment. The New York Times, which was, you know, just outraged beyond anything about the Russians, it also had something to say in this case. It said it had an editorial saying that no purpose is served by acrimonious debate over assignment of blame. That was the phrase they did in this situation of tension and so on. That was the response in that case. Well, if you look back a little further, you can find other things too. For example, in 1955, an Air India plane was blown up with many people killed. In fact, including the people who were killed, was the whole Chinese delegation to the Bandung Conference, the neutralist conference that was held in Indonesia. It turned out it was set by a CIA, the bomb was planted by a CIA agent who later defected and told the story. This was called by the Hong Kong police open premeditated murder or some phrase like that. The purpose of the operation was to kill Zhou Enlai, the Chinese premier, who was supposed to be on the plane but by accident had gotten off. So they killed the rest of the delegation plus everybody else but not him. Okay, that's 1955. And if you bother, you'll find other cases too. All of this is ignored. You know, the one case which was even mentioned, the Israeli one, was falsified. But all of this is ignored. While we have this huge hysteria whipped up about the worst monsters in history, which proves that, like I say, we have to attack Nicaragua and so on and so forth. And the press went along with this virtually 100%. The LA Times is the only newspaper in the United States that I know of that published an honest account of the Israeli case by Robert Scheer. I don't know of any, he published a straight factual account which gave essentially what I've just said. The other cases were never mentioned, and the rest of the press, as far as I, maybe there's something I missed, but the rest of the press didn't mention any of this stuff. Now, you know, here's an example of the way a really well-disciplined propaganda system works. Total obedience, total subservience to state propaganda. You know, when the state says, whip up hysteria against the evil empire, everybody starts screaming and yelling and jumping up and down and screaming about the evil empire. How do you pull that off? That's a very interesting question. See, if it had happened in, say, Nazi Germany or the Soviet Union, we'd know how they pulled it off. Namely, an order came from the Ministry of Truth and everybody had to obey it. Now, that didn't happen here. Here it happened in the way American propaganda always works, by servility and cowardice and class interest. In other words, we have a relatively centralized media, and there are great advantages to subordinating yourself to external power, which in fact represents your interests anyhow. You know, the mass media are basically big corporations, and they share the interests of other major corporations, which means the interests represented by the state. So it's not too surprising that they would tend to support state power. What is interesting is the uniformity, you know, the virtual lack of deviance. I mean, the fact that in a country as complex as this, one article should appear, namely by Bob Scheer in the LA Times, referring to one of these incidents, and the others, I suppose, were barely reported at all. This is something that you find over and over again in looking at the American propaganda system. So, for example, say, take the invasion of South Vietnam. How did we succeed for 22 years in preventing essentially 100% of scholarship? You know, there's virtually no deviations. Preventing it from referring to a historical event that occurred, namely the American invasion of South Vietnam. There is no such event. Take a look, you know. Take a look in the encyclopedias and the history books and the specialized monographs and so on, and you'll see that there is no such event as the invasion of South Vietnam in 1962, or aggression against South Vietnam. It's just not there, you know. How do you get 100% obedience to this? Well, that's a question you really ought to ask yourselves, and it, you know, merits another talk. But the point is, you ought to ask yourselves very much, because most of you, I can judge by your ages, are right in the middle of being trained to be able to do this kind of thing. You know, we have a very intricate system that, and it does it with consummate skill. You know, it does it with consummate skill and with great, you know, great success. So on major issues, you just get no deviation at all. I wish there were time to talk about this topic. It merits a full lecture in itself, but anyway, it's a fact, and it's worth noting.